I think we've got our marketing right for this evening because looking on all the literature, I didn't see the word evangelism on it. Is that? Yes, good. Whew. That's why you've actually come. Because what I find is when you put the word evangelism or evangelist anywhere on the publicity, it radically reduces the need for tea and coffee afterwards because there's no one there. I've said already that I'm reticent to reveal to people that I am an evangelist. It's actually on my business card. It's my job description. I'm an evangelist. And usually people don't understand what that means if it doesn't have the prefix tele. And that's what they think. They think of a tele-evangelist when they think of an evangelist. And I don't know. I wonder what you think. What are some of the words, adjectives, images that spring to mind when you think of an evangelist? What do you think of? Billy Graham. Billy Graham. Yes, you go straight for Billy Graham. Yes. Yeah. I think most of us do, don't we? Yeah.
Somebody standing on a street corner.
Okay. A street evangelist. And then getting prosecuted for it. Yes. Someone with a loud voice. Yes. What else? Someone who reaps a harvest, so sticking with the agricultural language of Mark 4. Not just someone who sows a seed, but actually someone who sees people come to Christ. Yeah, and you had?
Preaching fire and brimstone.
Preaching fire and brimstone. Yeah, absolutely. And as you think of an evangelist, what gender are you thinking about?
Male,
aren't we? Pretty universally, probably with a massive beard and a megaphone, and no matter where I do this, these are all the adjectives that people describe. They describe this motor mouth, kind of loud mouth, alpha male type personality with the gift of the gab who could sell ice to Eskimos, but he happens to be selling Jesus. And it's this kind of, you know, and I've even told you that I am an evangelist, and nonetheless, you've still hurt my feelings like this, but actually, you know that evangelists don't have feelings. That's one of the other things. We've got such thick skin that we don't care. This is the image of the evangelist, isn't it? But what I want us to do right now is turn to your neighbor, and for the next 2 minutes, I want you to describe somebody who was really helpful in your Christian journey, someone who really helped you be the Christian that you are today, someone who you look back to that person, you think, I think I'm a Christian, and this person had a significant role in me being a Christian today. And I want you to describe that person to your friend. Take 1 minute each, and let's go for 2 minutes. Go. Okay, let's start feeding back some of these new adjectives. Anyone want to share with the room some new adjectives, some new describing words for the people that have helped you be the Christian that you are today?
Personal.
Bible class leader. Say again?
Bible class leader.
Bible class leader. Yeah.
Drawing alongside.
Drawing alongside.
Friendship.
Friendship.
Gentle.
Persistent. It was taught the Bible at school.
Okay. Right. So teachers and those people were very important to you. Yep.
Youth leaders who made a commitment to the youngsters who were going to their youth group.
Right. And that was obvious to you as a youth. You thought, my leaders are committed. Okay. So camp leaders. Yep. Listener and an encourager. Yeah. I mean, it's okay if you were converted by a street preacher. Was anybody? A street preacher had something to do with my conversion, so, yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. We've just come up with a whole bunch of different adjectives there, haven't we? But everyone that you've been describing in these last few minutes, they have been an exceptional evangelist, haven't they? Because look at you. What a wonderful evangelist that person has been. Here you are. Here's the fruit of their labors. But it goes to show that it takes all sorts, doesn't it? And God's kingdom needs people to be bold and to stand out there and to have thick skin and to preach perhaps in the open air and to have that kind of personality. But God also needs the personal evangelist who draws alongside, who takes the youth group, who takes the Bible class, who volunteers at the summer camp, who is gentle and persistent and all those other things. God uses those personality traits as well because evangelism is a team sport. And if it's a team sport, then perhaps all of us have a part to play. You might not consider yourself to be an evangelist. There are people who are named as evangelists in the Bible. But just because there's one person who's named as an evangelist doesn't mean that all of us can't have a part to play in evangelism. There are some people who have the gift of administration. That doesn't mean we don't all have to fill out our tax returns, you know. There are some people who have the gift of giving money. That doesn't mean we leave it all to them, does it? You know, unfortunately, we all have to play our part in giving money. But just because there's a gifted evangelist doesn't mean that everybody else is off the hook. Actually, in Ephesians chapter 4, Paul says that God gives evangelists to the church to equip God's people for their works of service. And the works of service there surely includes evangelism, because that's part of the body's work. And so an evangelist, the named evangelist, is not just to get out there and do all the evangelism. The named evangelist is to face the church and stir up the church and the gifts in the church so that we can walk together as the evangelistic body that God has made us to be. And he's made us to be that evangelistic body with all sorts of different personality types. There's the bold person, and there's the humble person, and there's the one who draws alongside, and there's the one who's the straight talker, and we all come together in this glorious mess called church, and somehow God's kingdom grows. But what tonight and next week are all about is tapping into what the good news is so that all of us in our opportunities with our friends and neighbors can exercise evangelistic giftings. You might not be a named evangelist, you might be terrified by the word evangelism, but God has called you into his body and his body is an evangelistic thing. And so maybe over the next couple of weeks, we can learn a few things about the gospel that will help us to share it. And one thing that makes me think, or one thing I think through when I think about evangelism, is the phrase going viral. Do you know the phrase going viral? So last week, there was that poor professor on BBC World who was giving the interview. And it was hilarious, wasn't it? And the toddler walks in the background. Have you seen this video? And he's trying to get rid of the toddler. And then the nine-month-old bursts through the room. And then the mother comes through, this ninja mother who kind of tries to take these kids. And the video goes viral. Do you know the phrase? It goes viral. You share it, and then all your friends on Facebook share it, and their friends on Facebook share it, and their friends on Facebook share it, and exponentially it grows. And that's really how the gospel grows as well. As you share the good news, you know, what you like, you share. It's true on social media. It's true also in a spiritual sense. If you like the gospel, you tend to share it. If you love Jesus, you tend to speak of him. And Matthew 12, verse 34, Jesus says, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. So often people say to me, you know, I'm not very good with words. But then you get them on their favorite topic and you can't shut them up. Their football team wins on the weekend, you can't shut them up. They've got photographs of the grandkids. You're going to sit down and you're going to go through every one of those photographs on their phone. They're going to swipe through them and you're going to see them for the next 15 minutes. That's I've just bored Melissa with photographs of my kids. That's what happens. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. It's just true. So maybe a big problem in evangelism is that we don't like Jesus enough. It's a tragic problem, isn't it? But I wrestle with it every day. Do I know the goodness of the good news? Am I thrilled by Jesus every day? Because if it's not bubbling up out of my mouth, and if instead I'm talking about the cricket and the weather, well, what's going on in my heart? And maybe over the next couple of weeks, we can think about the goodness of the good news so that it starts to be out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. That's the idea. And we'll try and think about the gospel in a way that our friends and neighbors will understand. If they've never seen a Bible before, if they don't know anything about church or Jesus, we're going to think about the gospel in a way that relates to them, but hopefully in a way that really fires our own hearts in love for Jesus. Because I think what happens if you're going to go viral is, well, what happens with a virus? You know, I guess if you're going to spread a virus, you need to get close to the infected person, and then you need to get close to the rest of people, don't you? And if you just get close to the infected person, and if you just get close to other people, you've done a really good job of spreading the flu. Well done, you, okay? But that's the way the gospel's meant to work. We're meant to get close to Jesus and close to other people. We're meant to know God and know other people. Spend time with God and spend time with other people. And everything else is just window dressing, really. I'm not going to give you lots of tips and techniques about how to change a conversation from one direction into another direction. I don't think there are a lot of tips and techniques about evangelism, just as I don't think there are a lot of tips and techniques about spreading the flu. I just think you need to get close to the one who's got it, and then you need to get close to the ones who it needs to get, right? And it's the same with us. We're going to spend this week thinking about getting close to Jesus and understanding God, knowing God. And then we're going to think about understanding people, being curious about people, getting among people, and how we spread it. But first, as we think about knowing God, here's something I really want us to get clear on. If we're going to know God, which God are we talking about? Which God are we talking about? There's the story of the old, he's done many things in his career. He's been an author, he's been a bishop. But at one point, Tom Wright was the chaplain of Worcester College, Oxford. And he tells the story of being there, and in Freshers' Week at Worcester College, when you came up, you had to spend some time with the chaplain in Freshers' Week. Every fresher had to spend some time with Father Tom, or whatever they called him. It was a very, you know, embarrassing, awkward time for a lot of agnostic and atheist students who would just, you know, I'm sure it wasn't the most rock and roll thing in Freshers' Week in their diary, you know, spend time with the chaplain. And so they would confess to him at some point, I'm sorry, Father Tom, I don't actually believe in God. Now, for you or me, that would kind of end the conversation, usually, wouldn't it? We usually think, oh gosh, they don't even believe in God. What were those philosophical arguments again? I can't really remember. And what do I do? I don't know what to do. He just had a great response. Every time they said, I don't believe in God, he would just say, oh, which God don't you believe in? And the non-Christian would say, well, you know, just God, you know, just the big guy. And Tom Wright would press them. He said, describe to me the God in whom you don't believe. And usually they would describe some kind of distant individual, high on power, low on personality, that kind of Thor with a thunderbolt. And what did Tom Wright say? He said, well done. I don't believe in that God either. Let me tell you about Jesus. And as he did that, he's not just being clever, he's being deeply theological. He's actually doing what we say we believe. What we say we believe is that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through him. What we say we believe is that Jesus is the unique Son of God, the unique Word of God, the unique image of God. We say we believe that, but do we really? Do we really believe that God is the Jesus God? That Jesus really is the revelation of God. So John's gospel begins in this way. And what was brilliant at Durham and at Birmingham and at Belfast in these university missions is that everybody had John's gospel in their hands. They spent hundreds, at least thousands probably, on these John's gospels that everybody had in their hands. And it was just my privilege to open it up, and I would just say to them, so let's just open up and let's just get familiar with the most famous piece of literature ever written. John's gospel is the most translated part of the Bible, the world's all-time bestseller. Here is the world's greatest piece of literature. Let's get familiar with it. Crack it open, and what does it say? Well, it says, in the beginning was the Word, this title for Jesus. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. So Jesus is the Word of God. That means he's the explanation of God. He's the communication of God. You know, if God has a speech bubble coming out of him, what's in the speech bubble? Jesus. Jesus is the communication of God. He is what God is like. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So instantly we're getting this image of God is Jesus-shaped and Jesus is God-sized. Wow. Okay, God is Jesus-shaped because Jesus is the Word of God. He is what explains God to us. Whatever God we should have in mind, it should be the Jesus-shaped God. Lord Byron the poet, he once said, if God is not like Jesus Christ, he ought to be. Which I think is a deeply theological thing to say. Byron was not a Christian, but I think he was on the money with that one. If God is not like Jesus Christ, he ought to be. The good news is he is exactly like Jesus Christ because Jesus is the Word. So God is Jesus-shaped and Jesus is God-sized. Verse 3, through him all things were made. He is the creator, the source of being. Jesus is God-sized, which is wonderful to know, isn't it? As we're inviting people into the Jesus thing, we're not inviting them into this weird hobby that we enjoy. That, you know, we're into the Jesus thing, and some people, some people like Formula One, and some people like crochet, and some people like lawn bowls, and we just happen to like the Jesus thing. It's not like that, is it? Jesus is God. Yeah? The creator of all things. So God is Jesus-shaped. Jesus is God-sized. And then wonder of wonders, verse 14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth. So this one who explains God stepped into history and said, watch me as I live among you. And what did we see as we clapped eyes on Jesus? We saw grace and truth, which is a beautiful combination, isn't it? Grace and truth. Think of someone right now who's full of grace, someone who's full of mercy, full of forgiveness, full of sweetness and poise, full of grace. Now think of someone who's full of truth. They're very honest. They're a real straight talker, right? A Yorkshireman or an Australian or something, just full of truth. You've probably described just two different people, haven't you? You've imagined two very different people, someone full of grace and full of truth. And now imagine those two people together. Now you've imagined Jesus, like full of grace and truth and grace, this incredibly attractive combination. And so in evangelism, I take people through John's gospel and I sort of say, well, let's keep turning. Let's turn the page to chapter 2 of John's gospel. Let's see Jesus full of grace and truth. And what do you see in John's gospel, chapter 2? The first thing Jesus does to reveal his godness, what does he do? Goes to a party and he brings a lot of wine, doesn't he? 600 bottles of the finest red wine. This is interesting. This one comes among us, he says, I'm like God. He shows up to the party and he brings wine. The very next thing he does, I said, let's all turn the page. Let's see what's the next heading? It says, Jesus cleanses the temple. Let me tell you this story. After leaving the party, he goes to the holiest site on planet Earth among all these religious bigwigs with their long flowing robes, and he weaves a whip together out of cords and he drives out all the animals, overturns the money changers' tables, and he says, get out, you hypocrites. This is an interesting guy, don't you think? He goes to the party and he brings wine. He goes to the temple and he brings a whip. It's an interesting guy. What if this guy's God? What if this is what God is like? And you just let that sink in. Okay, and let's turn the page. And we turn the page and we see Nicodemus, this guy who is just rich and righteous and respectable, powerful, a ruler within Jerusalem. And Jesus says to him, you've got to be born again. And I say, have you ever heard the phrase born again? People say, yeah, I've heard that phrase again. I said, have you ever thought about how offensive it is? Here's Jesus telling it the truth, right? He's saying to this man who's at the top of his heap, he says, you got to be born again. That's really offensive. You know, I say, my daughter Ruby, she's 2 years old. If I had her with me this evening, you would see she is just absolute cuteness on legs. But if you came to me and you said, you know, when was she born? I say 2 years ago. If you say, I think she needs to be born again. Like, we are not friends at that stage. That's a really offensive thing to say. But if it's an offensive thing to say about a 2-year-old, how much more offensive is it to say about a righteous, respectable 40-year-old at the top of his game? But Jesus didn't mind that. He was full of truth. And he just gives it to Nicodemus. And then you turn the page and Jesus is with this woman. And I said, the Samaritan woman. Let me explain about Samaritans and Jews. They did not get on. These are two completely different cultures, and they were at loggerheads with one another. They hated one another. And all of Jesus' disciples would have thought that this woman was the wrong gender, the wrong nationality, the wrong religion, the wrong lifestyle. She's just wrong, 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 wrong. And Jesus just unloads heaven's richest blessings on her. He's just like, the first thing he says is, you know, I need to give you the living waters of my Holy Spirit. I need to eternally satisfy you with my joy. He's just giving her such grace. Who is this guy? He's full of grace and truth and truth and grace and truth. And I take them to the end of the gospel, and there you've got Jesus on the cross, and there he's telling the truth about us. Because this is where God comes to meet us where we are. And he's telling the truth. And he's saying, look, for me to meet you where you are, I've got to meet you in a pit of hell. That's what you are like. As Jesus cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's taking what we deserve. And so Jesus is telling the truth about humanity. We are in deep trouble. But he's also full of grace, isn't he? Because why is he there? He's there to save us. He's there to take our hell and give us his heaven. He's just full of grace and truth and truth and grace. What do you make of Jesus? Do you think he might be God? And as I'm trying to convince people that Jesus might be God, I'm not trying to get their arm up behind their back until they say, okay, fine, Jesus is Lord, fine. I'm actually inviting them into the wonderful revelation that God really is the Jesus God. Could that be true? Could it be true that the one with his arms outstretched to the world is God? Is that what God is like? It'd be a stunning possibility to consider, wouldn't it? And that for me is kind of the essence of evangelism, just showing people Jesus and saying, what do you think? What do you think of Jesus? Might he be Lord? Might he be Lord? Of course, that's that big Bible phrase, Jesus is Lord. That's the summary of the gospel that Paul gives so often. Romans 10, for instance, or 1 Corinthians 12, the gospel is Jesus is Lord. Whatever you thought God was like before, have a look at Jesus. He is Lord. And so that kind of gives us our first sentence up our sleeve. That's what I love about Jesus. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, I'm going to give you four sentences up your sleeve. And what you'll notice about these sentences up your sleeve is that I don't give you the ending. You've got to come up with the ending. I get you going, and you've got to complete it. But I think the essence of evangelism is basically saying to your friends and family and neighbors, that's what I love about Jesus, dot, dot, dot. How do you complete that sentence? Should we break up into groups and practice on one another? What is it that you love about Jesus? And if you can tie it to a passage from the Gospels, all the better, but you don't have to. But why don't we spend the next few minutes encouraging one another and finishing that sentence, that's what I love about Jesus. Let's go.